Imagine a world, right, where a massive Russian military invasion of Israel is defeated. And it's not defeated by advanced defense systems or, international intervention.
Right, none of the usual things.
Exactly. It's defeated by literal fire and brimstone falling from the sky. And the United States, it isn't even around to watch the spectacle.
Because the country has already completely collapsed from within.
Right. It's a pretty staggering scenario to try and visualize.
Oh, absolutely. It really is.
And today, we're taking a deep dive into the source material that paints exactly this picture. So we are looking at a YouTube sermon transcript from May 3, 2026.
Which is titled, The Fall of the World's Lesson 10.
Right, from a channel called New Life Benson. And before we jump in, our goal today isn't to endorse or debunk the theology here.
Nor are we taking sides on the intensely political viewpoints presented.
Exactly. Instead, we are putting on our anthropological hats, so to speak. We want to act as your guides to explore exactly how this specific speaker constructs such a terrifying, comprehensive worldview.
And really, how he masterfully weaves ancient biblical texts with, very modern, very present-day anxieties.
Right. That framing is essential for you as a listener to keep in mind. Because when we examine apocalyptic rhetoric, we're really looking at a specific lens through which a community views its reality.
And the narrative we are looking at is just sweeping. It's cinematic. And like many modern eschatological frameworks.
Meaning the theology of the end times, right?
Exactly. The timeline always seems to begin in the Middle East.
So to understand the mechanics of this timeline, we have to look at how the speaker interprets the book of Ezekiel. Specifically, I think chapter 38.
Right.
This text speaks of Israel and what it calls the Army of the North. And the speaker definitively identifies this ancient army, which the text calls Gog and Magog, as modern-day Russia.
And here is where the mechanics of, modern prophecy interpretation become incredibly interesting, because the speaker points out a very specific crucial condition.
A condition for the invasion, right?
Right. A condition that must be met in the text for this Russian invasion to occur. According to Ezekiel, Israel must be living peacefully in, quote, unwalled villages.
Unwalled villages.
Dwelling securely without bars or gates.
Which is, the exact opposite of reality today. Anyone who watches the news knows Israel currently has literal physical walls.
Extensive missile defense systems.
All right. And they exist in a perpetual state of high security. They certainly don't feel completely safe. So the speaker faces this huge contradiction between the ancient text and modern reality.
And how does he bridge that gap?
Well, he concludes that this state of ultimate vulnerability points to a future event, specifically a future 3.5-year peace covenant during a biblical period known as the Tribulation.
Which is exactly the kind of interpretive bridge we see often in these sermons. The logic dictates that this temporary, perhaps supernaturally enforced peace makes Israel entirely complacent.
They just drop their defenses.
Right. But the vulnerability isn't what triggers the invasion. It is, according to him, their sudden immense wealth.
The source claims Israel will become this irresistible target because of unprecedented prosperity.
Yeah.
And I find the specific examples the speaker uses here really fascinating.
Because he doesn't just mention vague riches.
No. He cites their modern expertise in drip irrigation, turning barren deserts into massive agricultural hubs. And he also points to vast reserves of rare earth minerals waiting to be extracted from the Dead Sea.
Which perfectly maps, an ancient concept of plunder onto the driving forces of the 21st century global economy.
Absolutely.
I mean, rare earth minerals are the lifeblood of modern technology and military hardware.
But let me challenge the geopolitical logic of this scenario for a second. Let's look at this setup. Like a geopolitical honeypot.
Okay.
We have a nation that is unimaginably wealthy, practically holding the keys to the modern technological age, and they have completely dropped their physical defenses.
Sure.
Wouldn't that tempt any opportunistic nation on Earth? I mean, why does it specifically have to be this one northern army, Russia, that makes the move?
Well, from a conventional secular military perspective, your question makes perfect sense. A defenseless, wealthy nation would trigger a global land grab.
Right.
But we have to view this through the speaker's theological framework. The source frames this invasion not as the result of random geopolitics, but as a deliberate divine trap.
Oh, interesting.
The text suggests that God is the one setting the hook. The purpose isn't just about resource acquisition. It's about drawing an antagonist out into the open to deliver a devastating, completely supernatural defeat.
Turning the mountains of Israel into a theater where the entire world will witness divine power.
Precisely.
So the bait is set, the trap is sprung, and the army of the North invades. But this brings up another massive contradiction in the text.
Which is?
If a major world power like Russia attacks an unprotected, unwalled Israel, how do they possibly lose?
Right, it doesn't make sense militarily.
Exactly. The speaker answers this by describing a conflict that isn't actually a military engagement at all.
It is entirely one-sided. There are no tank battles or dogfights mentioned. The destruction comes purely from above.
According to the sermon, God annihilates the invading Russian army using earthquakes, flooding rain, great hailstones, and fire and brimstone.
The chaos is so profound, the terror so absolute, that the invading troops actually turn their weapons on each other in the confusion.
The destruction is just total. And what strikes me is how the source provides some incredibly granular, almost morbid logistical details about the aftermath.
It really attempts to reconcile the vocabulary of a 2,500-year-old prophecy with the realities of modern conflict.
The logistics he pulls from the text are just mind-boggling. The speaker notes that the Israelis will spend 7 full years burning the leftover weapons of the invading army.
7 years?
Yes. The text explicitly mentions shields, bows, and spears being used as fuel. This cleanup effort even spills over into a future era called the Millennial Kingdom.
And the cleanup of the bodies, too.
Right. Furthermore, it will take them 7 months just to bury the dead in a designated area called the Valley of Ham and Gog, simply to clear the travel routes and deal with the overwhelming stench.
It is a highly visceral picture of divine retribution. You can see how the speaker uses these ancient agrarian descriptions, you know, burning wooden weapons for fuel, and presents them as literal future realities.
Right, perhaps implying a post-technological world or simply trusting the ancient text over modern military understanding.
Exactly. But the narrative takes its most crucial psychological turn right after the smoke clears, because God does not receive the earthly credit for this victory.
He doesn't. And that is a massive twist in the timeline.
It really is.
The Antichrist, who the speaker says is leading an army of the West stationed nearby in Jerusalem, steps right into the power vacuum. He takes full, unashamed credit for the supernatural destruction of the Russian forces.
It's like a politician taking credit for a booming economy they had absolutely nothing to do with.
Exactly, but executed on a cosmic, terrifying scale.
He capitalizes on the sheer astonishment and terror of the global population.
He really does. He uses this incredible momentum to outlaw all other religions instantly. He absorbs the false church, sets up his own image in the rebuilt temple in Jerusalem, and mandates a strict global economic system.
The speaker references the famous passage from Revelation here, right?
Yes, stating that no one will be able to buy or sell anything without receiving the mark of the beast.
The underlying psychology the speaker is describing here is remarkably astute. By taking credit for an inexplicable divine event, the Antichrist weaponizes a global crisis.
Absolutely.
Think about human nature. When people are deeply terrified, when they're struggling to comprehend an event that shatters their understanding of reality, they desperately seek a strong man.
They look for someone to provide order.
Right. The Antichrist provides that illusion of control, turning a moment of divine intervention into his own crowning achievement. He leverages panic into absolute spiritual and economic authority.
It's a masterclass in crisis management, turned utterly malevolent. But, you know, as history shows us repeatedly, absolute power held by one individual is incredibly fragile.
Very true.
And the sermon's narrative shifts rapidly to show how quickly the Antichrist's iron grip on the globe begins to slip away.
Because the illusion of his invincibility is about to be shattered, and shattered by forces he cannot even pretend to control.
Right. The source explains that God begins breaking the seals mentioned in Revelation chapter 6. This is where the timeline unleashes absolute cosmic chaos.
We are talking about devastating plagues.
A global famine that kills a quarter of the Earth's population. Massive earthquakes and astronomical anomalies like the sky rolling up like a scroll, the sun turning black and the moon turning blood red.
At this point, the basic foundations of human survival are completely stripped away.
And the speaker notes that the global population begins to panic, but more importantly, they begin to blame the Antichrist.
The logic makes perfect sense.
Right. If he claimed to be the all-powerful savior who single-handedly defeated the Russian army with fire from the sky, why can't he stop the actual sky from falling now?
Exactly.
This sudden exposure of his weakness invites an immediate, massive counterattack from what the text calls the Army of the South.
Which the speaker identifies primarily as Egypt, drawing heavily on prophecies from the book of Daniel, specifically chapter 11.
This is another moment where the speaker maps ancient prophecy onto modern history. He traces Egypt's relevance back to the 1950s under President Nasser.
Noting how Nasser built Egypt into a formidable power.
Right. The speaker then forecasts future alliance between Egypt and a severely weakened but resurgent Russia. This new coalition will march on the Antichrist in Jerusalem, utilizing chariots, horsemen, and ships.
And this mobilization marks the beginning phases of what eventually culminates in the Battle of Armageddon.
Now, I have to pause here, because I struggle with the sheer whiplash of this timeline.
It moves fast, sure.
How does the global population go from total terrifying submission under a one-world ruler? I mean, a system so strictly enforced that you can't even buy a loaf of bread without his mark, to massive multinational armed rebellion so quickly.
It is a rapid deterioration, certainly, but the source depicts human loyalty as entirely transactional and incredibly fickle.
Okay, I see.
The cosmic plagues serve a very specific function in the narrative. They erode the illusion of the Antichrist's invincibility. When the tightly controlled economic system fails and daily survival is threatened by famine and cosmic disasters, primal fear simply outweighs ideological loyalty.
Right, survival kicks in.
The plagues turn a rigidly consolidated empire back into a chaotic free-for-all. It destroys the strongman's aura of order, setting the stage for a desperate global power grab. And that leads all nations directly into the final conflict of Armageddon.
So with Russia regrouping, Egypt marching north, and a totalitarian one-world government trying to hold its ground in the Middle East, there is an obvious, glaring question hanging in the air.
Especially for anyone listening to this sermon in the United States.
Exactly. Where is America during all of this global upheaval?
For an American audience listening to this specific timeline, that is always the most pressing question. You have a superpower today, and yet they seem entirely missing from the grand finale.
The speaker addresses this directly, asserting that America is completely absent from the Book of Revelation.
And the reasoning he provides is stark, isn't it?
Very uncompromising. He says America will have already destroyed itself from within. According to the sermon, the United States will be entirely insignificant on the global stage by the time these biblical events occur.
And crucially, the speaker doesn't leave this as some vague, distant possibility or a strictly theological mystery. He grounds this internal collapse in very specific, highly recognizable present-day anxieties.
He absolutely roots it in today's news cycle. He uses real-world examples to validate this theory of impending doom. For instance, the speaker claims that Chinese entities are buying up large percentages of American farmland. He emphasizes that they are purchasing land specifically around military installations and taking over massive food processing plants. He also highlights the concept of, quote, birth tourism in Houston, Texas.
Claiming foreign nationals are arriving at pregnancy centers at a rate of 20 per day.
Right, to artificially create American citizens.
Let's examine the rhetorical function of these specific examples, though. Because these are highly charged contemporary fears.
Fears about loss of sovereignty, economic vulnerability, demographic change.
Exactly. And they are being mapped directly onto an ancient apocalyptic text.
It is a striking rhetorical choice. Mm. He tells his congregation that the enemy doesn't even need to defeat the United States militarily. They don't need to fire a single shot.
They are simply waiting for the country to fall apart from the inside due to these mounting internal pressures and cultural shifts.
Right.
If we look at how apocalyptic frameworks function sociologically, this strategy makes perfect sense. These frameworks constantly utilize current headlines to validate their interpretations of ancient texts.
So it feels immediate.
For the speaker's audience, the lack of an American presence in biblical prophecy isn't seen as a missing puzzle piece that requires complex theological gymnastics to explain. Instead, it is offered as definitive, terrifying proof of the country's imminent internal decay.
It validates the deep anxieties they already feel about their changing world, their changing neighborhoods, and their economy.
Exactly. By placing these cultural fears into a prophetic framework, he elevates them. They are no longer just political talking points. They are signs of a divine schedule unfolding exactly as predicted.
And that brings us to the ultimate pastoral purpose of this sermon. We have traced a truly terrifying global timeline. We've gone from the supernatural destruction of invading armies to cosmic plagues, the rise of a terrifying global dictator, and the internal agonizing collapse of the United States.
It's a lot.
It is. But the speaker isn't sharing this simply to teach a theoretical history lesson of the future. He is using this narrative as an urgent pastoral tool.
The entire timeline is constructed to provoke an immediate, deeply personal response from the listener.
The speaker ends the lesson with a solemn, emotional warning. He urges the congregation to ensure their own salvation first. Then he presses them to secure the salvation of their spouses, their children, and finally, their grandchildren.
The driving motivation here is pure protection.
He wants to help his loved ones escape this coming misery, which he describes without hesitation as the most terrible time in all of human history. He makes it visceral, mentioning that the true believers who find themselves living during the Antichrist's reign will be reduced to living like street people.
Completely shut out of the global economy, unable to access food or shelter.
It is a fascinating and powerful dynamic. The sermon uses the macro, the fall of nations and cosmic wars, to drive action in the micro, within the family unit.
Right.
But analyzing this entire sermon leaves us with a much broader psychological question to ponder. Why do humans, across incredibly diverse cultures and throughout thousands of years of history, continually find such resonance in the idea that the world is ending in their own lifetime?
It's a pattern we see repeated generation after generation. Every era believes they are the final era.
Exactly.
Is it possible that believing in a highly structured, meticulously prophesied apocalypse, even one filled with horrific plagues, war, and famine, is actually more comforting to the human mind than the alternative?
That's an incredible thought.
Perhaps the idea of a completely random, unpredictable future where human events simply unfold without a grand architect or a divine script is the truly terrifying concept.
So we return to the core of why these narratives endure. We are always looking for precision. When the world feels chaotic, when the news cycle is overwhelming, and when modern anxieties about the economy or national security feel out of our control, an apocalyptic prophecy provides a definitive structure.
It tells the listener that the chaos isn't actually chaos at all.
Right. It has a reason, it operates on a precise timeline, and it features an ultimate, guaranteed conclusion.
It provides a reliable map for an otherwise unmappable reality.
And as we navigate an increasingly complex world, the promise that someone, somewhere, is still holding the script might just be the most powerful comfort of all.